Now, once more, the sequence for today's classes will be first on church history and then on the third article of the Creed. And not coincidentally, our church history will be, you'd never guess, on Halloween, which dramatically symbolizes the widespread de-Catholicization of the Western world. And the second part of our classes will be on the third article of the Creed, which is on the Blessed Virgin Mary. And with that, we'll have an outline, a chart. Then, if there are persons here who contributed to this handbook on the teaching of faith for parents and teachers, if there are, then they, of course, deserve a complimentary copy. Otherwise, I bought about 20 copies here, and they will be on sale for what they cost us to Xerox, namely $5. Before Christmas, we hope to have about 20,000 printed. As you may know, last week I went to Scranton, Pennsylvania, after over a year's preparation, to attend the first convention in 30 years of the Eucharistic Crusade, which is a division or branch of the Apostleship of Prayer, and more specifically, for children, to promote devotion to the Holy Eucharist, to teach the faith, to inspire the children in being apostles already from childhood, and to pray, and all under the aegis of the Sacred Heart. 9 nations in the world are so far doing this, and my Jesuit general told me he wants this back in the United States and gave me the orders, very happy to carry them out, of bringing the Eucharistic Crusade back into the United States. Pray, however, we have 35 dioceses . Well, these are copies of the Apostleship of Prayer Monthly Intentions for 1995. I'd rather not do this during class, but then if you take one, there probably would be enough, especially for one member of a family. That's the intentions of the Holy Father, and by the way, the Pope personally and prayerfully chooses these intentions for each month of the year. And there are always 2 sets of intentions, the general intentions and the mission intentions. For example, the January general intention for 1995 is the gift of distinguishing true from false cultural values. Is that very important? And the January mission intention is catechetical reformation, or better, catechetical formation that is both missionary and ecumenical. My friends, that's a hard, very hard combination. In other words, how to be friendly with Muslims, kind, Christian, charitable, at the same time try to convert them to Christianity. In any case, you've got about 20 sets here. Thanks, Bill. So I would say these are available, 130 pages, and they are deeply personal contributions on how to teach, share, and develop the faith, mainly put together by parents, because we are restoring the Eucharistic Crusade in the United States, and this is one step in that direction. Then, to remind some of you, as we come to the close of the month of October, there is still no charge for these. The Secret of the Rosary by St. Louis de Montfort. In any case, copies are still left, and this time, no charge. Then, on my way to Chicago last Friday, my pickup at the airport gave me a copy of the present Holy Father's latest book, Crossing the Threshold of Hope. Worth reading. I gave my first lecture on this book last Friday. Holy Father says things that you won't find elsewhere in print. As you may know, this book was a second thought. It was to have been a series of television broadcasts by the Holy Father in Italy. But the series did not come off. The Holy Father asked the journalist who was going to interview him on television, would he please write out the questions? The questions then became the theme of each chapter in this book. The publisher is Knopf, K-N-O-F-F, Alfred Knopf. And the price I've got here is $20. On the other hand, this was a gift to me. And the party told me, at least for a while, there was a 40% discount. You might, if you want to, save money. You might want to call up my friend who got the 40% discount in Chicago. His phone number. He may not appreciate this. His name is Bill Fairman. Fairman, one word. His phone number is 708-424-4550. 708-424-4550.
Father, maybe one of us could take the names of everyone who wanted to one of those at the discount rate and make only one call to Bill Fairman for the books instead of from everyone in the class.
Well, now, Marion, would you want to make the call?
I'll make the call.
And then you give your phone number. So, hopefully that discount is still available from a Chicago publisher. In any case, it was 40% last Friday still. Hopefully it'll still be intact. As he gave me a copy, he told me I got a 40% discount. It's worth reading, though, because I repeat, the Holy Father says things you won't find elsewhere in print. Also explains, by the way, what so many people have criticized, is what looks like leniency in dealing, say, with dissenters and heretics. In any case, read the book. Then, I went to the seminary, Sacred Heart Seminary, had my picture taken. Several times I just didn't show up for the photograph. They kept after me finally. Became a matter of conscience. Well, having both my picture taken, I thought I'd do a little apostolic work. So I went to the bookstore of the seminary and found an unusual assortment of books. I bought, among others, Catholicism by my dear friend Richard McBrien. This is an update on his former book, and he says the former book sold 150,000 copies. In any case, I got a discount. 35 dollars. I think I paid 28 for it. But I need books like this to refute what they call themselves dissenters. But I looked in the index to see what names were listed, and well, I saw two entries for Harton John A. So I figured if I'm in the book, I think I should buy a copy. In any case, he hasn't really changed. Pray for Richard McBrien. He has done incalculable damage to the Catholic Church in the United States. As you see, this is not an ordinary announcement. I know I am being taped. One last item. I'm not sure how many of you people get or know about the Human Life Review. How many of you get the magazine? It costs, I'm not sure, you know, $20 a year. Comes out four times a year. But it's worth it. This issue is about 96 pages, so it comes to about 400 pages for the year. It is by all odds the best, the most penetrating and revealing publication in any language on the pro-life movement. Anyone engaged in the pro-life movement, I would say, has a duty either to subscribe to the magazine or have access to it on a regular basis. The editor is a good friend of mine in New York. I encouraged him when he first started this, and I get my own copies gratis and even sent first class. In any case, I highly recommend this publication. This is the fall issue. As I mentioned, our next lecture then will be on the third article of the Creed, which is on Our Lady. Our present lecture is on Halloween. And it will be a lecture that I finished this morning, drawing on printed matter from sources that I consulted, although in drawing on those sources, I would change, remove, and of course add as I thought was necessary. Simply, Halloween. Halloween typifies a phenomenon that had become increasingly common in the Anglo-Saxon world. It is a phenomenon of one's Christian and even Catholic feasts and celebrations becoming paganized. The two most notorious are, of course, Christmas and Easter. Christmas trees and Santa Claus are the two popular symbols of what should be the feast of the birth of Jesus Christ. Easter is associated with rabbits and a new wardrobe for spring, whereas the feast of Christ's resurrection is all but ignored outside of strictly Christian communities. Since the beginning of television in 1941, organized television in our country, until about 1980, so that's about 40 years, all the Easter shows were exclusively about pagan and non-Christian events or symbols. Finally, through organized Christian effort and pressure, boycotting these stations, finally, they broke down and began giving little tidbits about the meaning of Easter. 40 years of dead silence on television in Chicago about the real meaning of Easter Sunday. Halloween, though not commonly known to be such, is actually even more notorious. It symbolizes what has happened in one's Catholic countries, thanks in large measure to the rise of anti-Catholic Protestantism in the 16th century. And whatever meaning you associate with Protestantism, be sure you don't forget that historically, Protestantism, the very name, is derived from protest against the Catholic Church. That's what Protestantism means historically. It's a protest against the Catholic Church and her teachings. The birthday of Protestantism is October the 31st, 1517. The vigil of the Feast of All Saints. On that day, Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses, as he called them, to the church door of the Castle of Wittenberg in Germany. Among these theses, Luther denied the church's right to give absolution from sins in the name of Christ. 3 years later, Luther was condemned by Pope Leo X as a heretic. And before Luther's death, in 1546, something like one third of Europe was lost to the Catholic Church. And it all began on Halloween, October 31st, 1517. In other words, in the mind of every Protestant, having taught, as I've told so many of you, in six Protestant seminaries, including the Lutheran School of Theology, for 7 years. And I never for a moment compromised on Catholicism. You think after 3 days they would throw me out bodily? Wow. I love Protestants. My widowed mother took in boarders, women boarders. And the first two boarders that stayed with us till I was, 16, were two Lutheran girls. I heard about Martin Luther by the age of 3. I'm sure they were the only Lutherans in the United States then, Susan and Judith, who abstained from meat on Fridays. My mother told them. I was asking embarrassing questions. Want to stay here? Talk to your pastor. No meat on Fridays. Pastor said, okay, so. I love Protestants, but I sure know the difference. Protestantism is not Catholicism. In the history of the world, therefore, the Vigil of All Saints is the birthday of Protestantism. The very name, Halloween, as we know, meant and should still mean, dear Lord, should still mean, as I've told so many audiences, and especially the missionaries of charity, no matter what country I teach them, I tell them, sisters, and most of them, by the way, when I ask them, how many of you spoke English as your native language at home? Almost never anyone puts up her hand. So I ask, how many of you did not speak English at home? Everybody puts up her hand. I put up mine too. I never spoke English at home. Never. Then I tell them, sisters, as I told Mother Teresa more than once, among your responsibilities, and English is the official language of the missionaries of charity, one of your responsibilities is to Catholicize the English language. They are now in 100 countries. Sisters from Tanzania, from Zambia, from you name it, some unpronounceable names of the places they're from. But they've got to learn English. They can't learn English, they don't have the vocation to that community. Catholicize the language. English is the most, not just un-Catholic, English is the most anti-Catholic language in human history. Do you hear me? English is the most anti-Catholic language in human history. English literature, libraries, tens of thousands of books written by those who not only did not share our Catholic faith, but were brought up from most of them, in infancy, in an atmosphere that was, to put it mildly, not friendly to the Catholic Church. the Feast of All Saints, and the corresponding, and was a vigil, of All Saints, the 31st of October before the 1st of November, middle of the 5th century, so it's over 1,500 years. And this vigil of the solemn feast of All Saints has now become a day of fun and prankish trickery. All, as we'll explain before this lecture is over, it will not be an ordinary lecture, I assure you. Not coincidentally, the followers of Martin Luther not only dropped the Feast of All Saints, they denied, from the very beginning, they denied the veneration of saints and called it superstition. It is Protestant heresy to honor the saints. Logically, then, the Vigil of All Saints became a day of mockery of the veneration of saints, or invoking their intercession in heaven with God. But there are no saints in heaven. This is a cardinal principle of both Luther and John Calvin. My plan for this conference, and this, by the way, is still the introduction. My plan for this conference is to cover the following areas of an immense subject. My plan is to trace the history of Halloween before the dawn of Christianity, its continued practice where Christianity had not taken a firm root, and its resurgence as pagan folklore where Catholic Christianity was weakened or suppressed by political power. And something of the responsibility of Catholics in English-speaking countries to restore Halloween to its truly Christian significance. The word itself, Halloween, spelled as we know with two L's and two E's, which is literally All Hallows, even, in other words, All Hallows means All Saints. In Old English, Hallows means Saint. All Hallows means All Saints. And E-N, double E-N, is the abbreviation for even, or evening, or the night before. In its strictly religious aspect, this is known as the Vigil of Hallowmas, or All Saints Day, November the 1st, and observed by the Roman Catholic, and to remind ourselves also, thank God, by the Anglicans. We mentioned that Pope Gregory III assigned this date for celebrating the feast when he consecrated a chapel in St. Peter's Basilica, and his successor then extended the feast to the whole church. Students of folklore believe that the non-Christian customs of Halloween, that they precede even the origins of Christianity, and more specifically, they are traced to the Roman harvest festival of Pomona and of Druidism. Pomona in the Roman Empire and Druidism in Germany, Scotland, and Ireland before the dawn of Christianity. These influences, so scholars tell us, are inferred from the use of nuts and apples as traditional Halloween fruits, and from the figures of witches, black cats, and skeletons, which were associated among the pagans before Christ. Hear this. In Latin countries, the evening of October the 31st is observed only as a religious occasion. But in Great Britain, that's where it got started. In Great Britain, and then exported to Ireland and the United States, ancient Halloween pagan customs have been restored alongside of the Christian observance. Evidence that Halloween reflects influences from the two sources we identified, namely from the goddess Pomona and from Druidism, is seen in the fact that as Catholicism was suppressed by Henry VIII and his successors, and remember, suppressed under persecution, what happened? Some of the hidden paganism among the people before the dawn of Christianity then rose to the surface. For example, the spirits of the departed were believed to visit their kinsmen in search of warmth and good cheer as winter approached. It's also the period for threshing and a food preparation for the winter season. Now, let me just touch on one aspect we won't have time to go into in detail. Over the centuries, the church has made a consistent effort, which, by the way, is brought out very clearly in this book by the Holy Father, that as far as possible, the church would keep, I repeat, as far as possible, the church would keep, for example, even the date of certain feasts or festivals. For example, the principal festival, which was dedicated to the sun god, was the name which then Christianity adapted, and in fact even adopted, for the Lord's Day, namely Sunday. So here, the church then, we don't want to say built on, that would be a mistake, but used the externals of certain, call them festivities, certain practices of the pagans before they were Christianized, but then solely baptized, not just the feast, but the meaning behind the feast, in such a way the people would not have to simply discard the feast as such, but the meaning of the feast. This is crucially important. As you read the pages in the Holy Father's book, keep that in mind. In other words, under divine guidance, the church tries, rather than crush or suppress or wipe out what is good among the people, to rather, once the people are themselves converted, to build on what is good. It better be good, however, and then give the people, as in this case, notice what the church did. Surely, the end of October, the beginning of November is, well, the time of the harvest. And the church then, building on that, would keep the commemoration of thanking God for the good that He had done. And of course, what's the most important harvest? My dear native, somebody can answer this question. What's the most important harvest in the mind of God? The most important harvest that He wants is souls. Souls. The souls that made it, and the Feast of All Saints, as the Church has been teaching over the centuries, is not just of canonized saints, but of all those who reached heaven. And the feast, as we'll explain, I may not have all the time. We've got more here, I think, than I have room for in one lecture. Well, then the poor souls the day after, for those who are still suffering in purgatory. And that's the highest and most sublime harvest which the Church wants all of us to commemorate. We go on. There is little doubt that the Church sought to either eliminate, but better, supplant the pagan festival of the dead, which, for example, we even expect the dead to visit. Remember we said this before? Visit their living relatives, well, this time of the year. And this is what the Protestants or comparative religionists say, the Church then, to replace the pagan practice of recalling the dead even coming back and appearing to their still living friends on earth, introduced the Feast of All Souls. As Christianity spread gradually over Europe and the British Isles, it tried, and I would say quite successfully, but note my language, quite successfully, to displace pre-existing pagan cults devoted to the worship of certain pagan gods. One thing we should remember, and the years of teaching theology to my own judges, 25 years to be exact, I've told them that in the northern countries, and I mean in general north of the Alps, in Germany, parts of Switzerland, and of course Norway, Sweden, Finland, England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, the missionary effort, though remarkably successful, had not been, and I think I may even use the verb, has not been, as effective as in the Mediterranean world, or say as successful as it had been in Africa. For example, in 325, the first general council of the church, which condemned, remember, Arius, who denied Christ's divinity. Now all the bishops assembled at Nicaea condemned Arius. The numbers we don't know for sure. Not the majority, but at least a sizable minority went back home to the diocese and sided with Arius, who denied Christ's divinity. And with almost no exception, they were from the northern, what we now call Anglo-Saxon countries. Do you hear me? Date, 325 AD. It is not then coincidental, by any means, in the years of teaching theology, oh, how I stressed, it is not just in the past generation or two, but over the centuries, the most devastating heresies have come from those same countries. And now, sad to say, pains me to say it, but say it I must. Not excluding Ireland, am I clear? When the Irish turn heretics, they become militant. By the end of the Middle Ages, the celebration of All Hallows Eve, or popularly Halloween. Even to use the word Halloween in a religious context seems to almost, well, blaspheme the name, which shows how deeply, our Anglo-Saxon culture has been de-Catholicized. By the end of the Middle Ages, the celebration of All Hallows Eve was an established part of the annual calendar of the Roman Catholic Church. Then came Protestantism, or, as its sympathizers call it, the Reformation. Never, unless you're in a daze and not responsible for what you're saying, never use the word. Never. Reformation to speak of Protestantism. Never. There was only one Reformation. And that was the Reformation of the Catholic Church. But you see how the very words have penetrated our English vocabulary. As I've said more than once, I'm sure to you too, and after 15 years of teaching theology in Latin to my Jesuit priests and scholastics, and then I was told by superiors, John, come this September, you've got to teach theology in English. Are you sure? Yes, it must be English. My greatest, I mean this, my greatest mortification in the priesthood. And the reason is not subjective on my part. The English language is simply not a vehicle for Catholicism. Do you still hear me? Just isn't. Where they use words that people don't ordinarily use, borrowed from the Latin,